Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you very much. And Anthony, thank you for your kind words earlier today. I'm going to talk about challenges in producing books in an electronic workflow this afternoon. This is something that we've been doing more and more work over the last 3 years. Now, when I was exchanging emails with Anthony over the last few months, and he was trying to work out the order of presentation for the day, he asked if I would follow Bill. What he didn't specify is which of Bill's presentations he wanted me to follow. How many of you were here 3 years ago, 2008? Okay, so a few of you, I apologize, I've only taken two slides from Bill's presentation. A few of you have heard this, books are messy. Really what my presentation is a much better follow-on to that presentation of Bill's than the one that Bill just gave. But there was one slide in particular, actually it was Bill's entire introduction that day that I really liked, because he stepped us very rapidly, about 15 steps, through the history of going from print journal production to full-text XML journal production. And then he ended up with point 16. What about all those books? And point 17, which is where he got all the laughs, was, let's see what Elsevier and Springer are all doing. And it made a very interesting jumping-off point for where Bill went that afternoon. What I'm going to do is jump beyond that, because there's a lot going on that isn't necessarily happening with the big book publishers. And in addition, a lot of what Elsevier and Springer do is oriented around monographic series. That's really the core of a lot of what their book content is. But books are much broader than that. And so I want to focus on that. And a lot of what I have to say is put together based on conversations I've had, in particular with small and medium-sized book publishers over the last 3 years or so, when they come to me and say, okay, so I want to do XML for books, and we start peeling back the layers of the onion and discovering what are the questions they have, what are the things they need to know. So some of this may be pearls of wisdom you already know just from your own experiences or working journals. Some of it I hope will be new. Just in brief, what I'm going to cover, I'm going to talk about what the DTD options are, a little bit of a reprise of what Bill talked about 3 years ago, XML and composition issues, file organization, metadata, fronts and backs of books, and challenges you hit within the body content. And I apologize, I know it's just about 5 o'clock, you're probably ready to hit the bar, and yes, I do have pointy angle brackets in here, so I will try not to dwell on them too long. Journals look, well, plain. They're very basic layouts. They're very repetitive. You can do them automatically with all kinds of composition systems these days. Whereas books look, well, to coin a term, designy. These are not monographic series, obviously. These are things like textbooks that we're talking about, field guides, all different kinds of books, but they do have, despite their for lack of a better term, more beautiful designs, they do have some degree of consistency. It's just, compared to a typical journal article, it's a broader range of consistent items that appear through a book. And so there's more effort that's put into them in terms of the design. So what's driving the book publishers towards XML right now? And really, in the last 3 years, last two in particular, we've seen a huge surge, really, of book publishers saying, what can I do to get to XML? Well, it's market demand. And what's driving the market demand? It's the multi-platform delivery. Kindle's been out now for about 4 years. iPad was the tipping point, to steal a popular term. iPad, when that shipped, that was the point when I could literally see the panic in the book publishers' faces. Because that was when they began to realize that 5 years from now, or 5 years from when iPad shipped, they're going to be doing more of their deliveries electronically than in print. And there are other driving factors in this. Let me just interject into my bullet points here and point out another one. How many of you have kids who are in school? Okay. How many of you have school districts with increasing funds available for educational programs? I'm putting my hand down, and I don't see a single one going up. Budgets for schools are declining. Okay, what does that mean to publishers? Well, what's one of the first things you cut when the school budgets go down? Well, let's not replace textbooks as often. Meanwhile, take a look at the medical side of things. What are pediatricians complaining about? How many kids are they seeing now with scoliosis? How many of you have looked at a 10-year-old walking to school with a backpack that's probably got about a quarter of their body weight. And I think the recommendation is it shouldn't be more than 10% of their body weight. It's the textbooks that are in there. I actually had an interesting experience recently. I went to my son's back-to-school night, and I'm waiting in line to meet his teacher at in his algebra classroom. And I notice by the door, or propping the door open, there's a chair with three textbooks on it. I looked at the one on top and thought, boy, that's an old-looking textbook. Almost looks like what I once used. And I picked it up, and believe it or not, I opened the nameplate, and I actually live in the town where I grew up. One of my classmates had actually used that textbook 35 years ago. And then I thought about it and said, you know what? That textbook is a lot smaller than the two underneath it in the pile. And I realized that the textbooks have gotten bigger in the last 35 years. Well, algebra hasn't changed, so why is that book bigger? It's the eye candy. Think about it. How much eye candy, and I hate to use the term, it sounds a little crass, but how much was there in terms of lines and drawings and fancy layout and pictures in the textbooks you all had when you were going through school versus what your kids have now? And there's a lot more now. This is what you have to hold the attention of kids in the post-MTV world. So this is all driving in a direction that I think is going to push publishers more and more towards ebooks, independent of what people actually say they want to buy at the consumer level or the professional level. And with these declining budgets for replacing textbooks, what's going to happen also is ultimately publishers are going to deliver electronically. In the long term, I think they're actually going to let teachers pick and choose and put together their own custom textbooks. But kids are going to have tablet devices to lighten up the backpack, and communities are going to end up licensing textbooks on a yearly basis. So the pricing model is going to change completely. So all of this is stuff that you need to be ready for. But coming back to my slide, what else is driving publishers to do XML for books? Believe it or not, it's production costs. Book publishers are starting to figure out that if they do XML right, it will cut their costs, just as journal publishers figured that out about 10 years ago, that doing XML wasn't necessarily a bolt-on to get an electronic product. If you integrate it properly into the workflow, you will cut costs, and ultimately that means you can cut delivery time. So the rationale for book publishers to do XML is actually very different than the journal publishers we've seen. And again, maybe not with Elsevier and Springer with the monographic series, but for a whole swath of other book publishers. Journal publishers were driven by focusing on what do I need to do online delivery and what do I need to deliver metadata. Book XML production is geared towards how do I cut my production costs on these very design-intensive books. And these days, how do I get to EPUB? Because they all need EPUB. So just drilling down a little bit more in a comparison of the issues. With journals, you have very standard designs. These are designs you can do with batch composition, 3B2, XPP. They're really well designed for, call it the sausage-making engine. You stuff the content in, and out comes your laid-out journal article. Whereas in books, the graphic designers have always ruled. And books are InDesign-centric. How many of you, leave aside monographic series for a second, how many of you are book publishers and you're not using InDesign? Not a single hand is up. How many of you are book publishers and you are using InDesign? Okay. So InDesign rules in the book world. In a way, it doesn't in journals. So in journals, we have automation, automation, automation. There's been a huge drive for that, and part of that goes back to the offshoring that we were talking about this morning, but part of that is driven by what you can do. And in book publishing, it's been, let's do this all by hand. And that's what's changing, is the let's do it all by hand. So, and part of why it's changing also is because inherently the XML production requirements are contradictory to a let's do it all by hand, let's do these beautiful designs by hand. And so we're starting to address this issue. And the first way we're starting to address it is just, what are the DTDs we can use for book publishing? Unlike journals where it has largely coalesced around the NLM DTD, or now known as JATS, there are more choices for books. Some common choices that you might hear bandied about are TEI, DocBook, NLM, aka JATS, because there is a book version, DITA. We still also run into publishers who roll their own with proprietary DTDs. So how do you choose amongst these? Well, my personal advice is I'm going to first advise that you don't go with a proprietary DTD when there are lots of standards out there that you can work with as a foundation, even if you don't use the standard exactly as it was built. I'm actually working with one publisher right now that has a very hierarchical proprietary DTD that they developed about a year ago, and they're starting to figure out that it's costing them more in their overall end-to-end cost because they can't use any off-the-shelf tools with it. So how do you base, what do you base your selection on? There are a few criteria. The first is, are you doing just front list? Are you including backlist or historical content? What discipline are you in actually does make a difference, as you'll see in a minute. What are your XML use cases? And you need to have some idea of what you want to do with the XML before you go ahead and plunge into this. If you're just doing it for the sake of XML, you're going to get burned in the end. You really need to understand, you know, what are my three top business reasons for why I want to have XML? And sometimes the tools you want to use can help determine. For example, anyone who's ever used FrameMaker knows that FrameMaker in the XML model is very heavily biased towards DocBook. So if you're going to use FrameMaker, you might consider using DocBook if all other factors are equal. And yeah, just a quick lesson on the DTDs. TEI comes out of the academic community, originally Brown University. It's widely used in humanities. So that goes back to my point of you might want to look at what discipline you're in. It's also fantastic for historical materials. It's the only one of these standards that's really designed, for example, to be able to record where page breaks were, which is why it's great for historical materials. It's also great for things like poetry. Of the major standards I'm talking about, it's probably the least well-known among suppliers, and it's probably got the weakest in terms of commercial tool support. DocBook originally comes out of O'Reilly. It's great for technical publications and trade books. There's a lot of commercial tool support. I mentioned FrameMaker, ArborText was also originally built around DocBook. It is very well known by suppliers, and it's an OASIS standard, so it's housed within a standards body that helps maintain it. NLM JATS, full disclosure here, I have a personal bias. I've been involved in this standard for about 10 years now, so I know it fairly well. Its origins come out of the needs for scholarly journal archiving and as a secondary matter publication. It's widely used by journal publishers at this point. It's great for science publications or multi-authored works. It's great for publishers who are doing journals already with NLM and have a corresponding book program. We've worked with one publisher that actually does journals and then repurposes a fair number of its journal articles into multi-chapter books. And it's great because they just literally have to change the metadata header and they've got new content that they can put right into a book. And it's great for content with structured references. It's very well known by suppliers. It's a NISO standard or about to become a 1.0 NISO standard early next year. Admittedly, the book model is not as mature as the journal model. However, there is now a working group that's working on a significantly revised book version. I'm expecting that probably a draft of this will be out sometime in the second half of 2012, and it's going to be known as BITS, Book Interchange Tag Suite. So we have JATS and BITS now. But 3.0 is usable for books today. We've actually used it for quite a number of projects with different organizations. You'll notice I don't have a slide about DITA, and that's because I'm just going to plead ignorance, and I generally haven't found book publishers who are using it. It's not a standard that I have a lot of familiarity with. It seems to be more popular in the corporate world. So, all things being equal, excuse me, how do I choose amongst these? Well, if you just have simple monographs, all of them are going to work. But also, for anything that you want to do, all of them are designed for customization. So if it doesn't do exactly what you want, read the guidelines. You can go in and customize them. Talk next about creating the XML. There are four basic places your XML can come from. The first is the author, non-starter. How many of you have ever had an author submit an XML manuscript?
25% of lawyers submit to law publishers in XML.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh, what tools are they using?
Wow,
I'd love to see the link.
I know who.
Thank you. I learn something new every day. In scholarly publishing, how many of you have ever had somebody submit an XML article?
I like to throw these technical points out.
You keep us honest, Anthony. The reality is you're not seeing it. And even if you did get XML, you'd probably look and say, is this usable? Does this, this is someone who's a biologist or a physicist. Do they really understand the innards of my DTD and exactly how I want it to work with it? So the reality is I don't think you're going to be seeing XML coming from authors. Flip to the far end of the process, there are still a fair number of people who are doing their XML after the PDF. This is quite common as a post-publication process. It's not a workflow that I particularly like, and for a couple of reasons. First of all, it slows down the overall publication process. You have to wait to have your XML converted out from the PDF, typically offshore. And second of all, it's less robust in that when you create the PDF, that's what you proof. When you create the XML from the PDF, you don't then reproof the XML. So you have no guarantee that the XML is 100% correct. Whereas if you reverse it and you create the PDF from the XML, you know the XML is right. So two other possible places. One is after the author gives you the manuscript, but before you copy edit. This requires the editor's work in XML, and most organizations aren't looking to retrain their editors on working in XML directly. So the place I like most is to insert the XML after copy editing but before composition. I think this is sort of the best compromise overall in terms of how many people need to work in the XML and the quality issue of making sure your PDF is created from the XML. Now, this presents the typesetting issue. How do you typeset this XML in InDesign when you're in a world where basically all these books are being done with InDesign? InDesign has very limited XML support. It works okay if you've got relatively flat XML, but if you've got a richly hierarchical DTD like DocBook or TEI or NLM, it's not easy to get XML in, and it's a lot harder to get it back out of InDesign. But there are ways you can try to sort of automate this by at least taking that hierarchical XML and maybe write some scripts. Or there are commercial tools that can do this. They can sort of flatten it out and feed it into InDesign. And in the most sophisticated form, what you can even do is have that begin to automatically lay out the pages. So automatically place floating objects or footnotes as part of the process. And taking advantage of that is critical if you want to stay in InDesign so you can still make all those design tweaks easily, but you want to save time in the publication process. So that's really a critical thing to look at. So a lot of publishers say, well, how can I typeset this XML? And I say, well, here are your options. You can write your own scripts, you can look at commercial tools. But you really do need to be looking at that if you're going to stay in InDesign, and most of these publishers do want to do that. The biggest problem in this is the corrections part of the workflow. Once I'm in InDesign, how do I handle the corrections? Because there is not a good way to make corrections in InDesign and then get full, hierarchical, richly tagged XML out the back end. Unless you want to do a lot of very fancy transforms on the back end where you basically take this relatively flat XML out of InDesign and then write the scripts to do the enrichment yourself. That can be a bit of a challenge. So what are your options? One is to do that, which is to basically export the InDesign markup language out of InDesign and do scripts to enrich it. Another is you can work on a workflow where you try to automate as much of the page layout as possible with your upfront XSLT, that what you can do is keep feeding the XML into InDesign, where you actually make the corrections either upfront in the XML or maybe even further upfront in Word, regenerate the XML, and flow it in a circular workflow like that into InDesign. It sounds a little counterintuitive, but we're working with a number of publishers where they found that that actually works very effectively because it allows the editors, who are the ones who know the content best, to actually make the changes in an environment that they're comfortable with, typically Microsoft Word. Okay, I'm going to dive down now into some more nuts and bolts stuff. File organization. Some things you need to think about. Is your book one big file, or is it one chapter per file? And the answer is it depends. It depends on whether or not your individual chapters can stand alone. Will they be sold individually? Are you planning to repackage individual chapters into a different product? If so, then you want to make them individual files. On the other hand, if you make them individual files, but you've got a back of the book footnote section or a back of the book bibliography or a back of the book index, you're suddenly going to discover that linking between the files is a much more challenging problem. So one of the things you may need to do is step back and think about, how is my content organized? You may pragmatically decide, well, some books we're going to do as chapters and some we're going to do as one monolithic XML file. It really depends on your content. There is no single right answer there. But these are things that you need to think about. File naming. You'd be amazed how often I start talking to book publishers, again, typically smaller and medium-sized publishers. I ask, what's your naming convention for files? I don't know. Don't have one. Okay. If you're going to get into an XML workflow, you want to have some sort of consistency in your file naming. Random is definitely not good. I also don't recommend using a file naming system based on the author names. A couple of reasons. What if you have three books by Smith? Not an uncommon problem. Or worse, what if you have accented letters in the author name and then you suddenly start getting accented letters showing up in attributes in the file because you're using those names for pointers out to the graphics as well? You don't want to do that. So you want to keep it to something that's going to be plain 95-character ASCII, fairly simple character set, same kinds of rules you'd use for assigning DOIs. So what's a good file naming scheme? Potentially an internal book ID, BK12345, or potentially the ISBN, which a number of publishers we work with have used. So what you do is you extend this out. You start out with your core ID for the book, and then for each chapter becomes C001, C002, and a lot of publishers we work with like doing the zero padding. Because that way, if you look at the files in a file system, you can very quickly scan down and see that they're all there in order. Instead of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, boom, 1 and 10 are next to each other when you do that. So little things to think about. And also think about what's your file naming convention for fronts and backs, introduction, preface, bibliography as well. You want to have some consistency through all of your publication process on this. So you want to design a system that's logical and consistent, not just for the books, but also for all the artwork. You want it to be unambiguous, because you want to basically have a set of instructions you can give to the people who take care of all the graphics and say, here's our naming conventions for all of this. And you also want it to minimize the manual work and file preparation. Almost every publisher that we've worked with in a pre-XML workflow, meaning they're still using their old methods, a manuscript editor, at the point of figure one and figure two and so on, in each chapter, goes through and types in the name of the file. Well, that's potentially error-prone. What we recommend instead is if there's a consistent pattern, when you convert the Word document to XML, you can have something that automatically picks up, oh, this is figure one. Let's tack on a name based on our book ID, chapter number, and figure number. So it's all automatic. You reduce the typing, you reduce the file prep time, you gain efficiency, you gain accuracy. So a lot of these ideas are holistically fitting together to cut costs and gain accuracy. In the actual XML file, I think most of you who've worked with journals already know this, you typically don't include the file extension for the graphics. Why? Different platforms are going to end up using different file types. You may use TIFF when you're going into your print production, when you're rendering the XML for print. You might use GIF for going to online. And so you want the file extension typically assigned at the render point rather than in your XML up front. So these are some examples of naming conventions, but notice I've not just covered figures here, but also things like plates, maps, exhibits, equations, all the different things. And one of the things we ask people to do is when we start working with them, make an inventory. What are all the different kinds of things that you see? One publisher has musical examples that we work with. Another has illustrations and photos. And so we work with them to make sure they inventory these and then make sure they've got a clear scheme that they can use for all of these different types of art. And the reason this is uniquely different from journals is journals, the art types are much smaller. It's typically figures, plates, and schemes, maybe a chart or a diagram. Books have a much wider range of types, so you've got to give this more thought. You do run into special circumstances. The first and most common is you're going to have a lot of graphics that aren't numbered, particularly in, say, textbooks for high school kids. They don't call them figure one, figure two. They just stick them in, image one, image two, image three. You want a unique scheme that can handle those because you'll also get chapters that will have both numbered and unnumbered figures. So maybe UN for unnumbered. And then there are special cases. I was actually talking to one publisher last week who said, listen, we're doing this field guide on, I think it was dragonflies, and we want to be able to resort all of the different sections without worrying about the number, the order of the numbers. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 might next week be 1, 2, 5, 4, 3 if we shuffle the sections. So I said, okay, for that, let's actually use the names of the images. So this name right here matches this image, and this is a case where you would end up having to type the file name into the Word file as part of, or the XML file as part of doing the file prep. But it's more pragmatic because it, in this case, more uniquely binds the image together with the content. So you need to think through your cases carefully on these kinds of things. Equations. Bill was mentioning that MathML is part of the EPUB 3 spec. What he didn't say is what percentage of the hardware device manufacturers are actually going to support it. Thank you, Bill. Not to mention the fact that we're all still waiting for Microsoft to support MathML with Internet Explorer, even 9. Despite several public pleas, Microsoft just seems stuck and they don't want to support MathML, even though MathML is part of the HTML5 spec. So what we are typically recommending publishers do is they hedge their bets. Put the MathML in your XML, but also have images for each of the display equations or complex equations. And then on the fly, you can switch between the two, depending on how you have to deliver. The other thing, by the way, is in an InDesign-centric world, remember that InDesign doesn't naturally handle MathML. There are plugins that can render it, but oops, trying to get the MathML back out the back end has a few challenges. So future-proof. Have both some sort of tag markup as well as images. Metadata. Book publishers are used to thinking about, well, what do I need to do for my Onyx delivery so I can get my book listed on Amazon? What they're not used to doing is thinking about a broader set of what are my metadata requirements. So again, we sit down with publishers and say, let's do an inventory of what's the metadata that you think you need for your books or your book chapters. Okay, let's start with ISBN. How many ISBNs do you want? We work with one publisher that has 3. We work with another publisher that I believe has 8 ISBNs on each chapter. Unfortunately, the guidance here is a little bit unclear right now. BISG does have some recommendations. Not everyone follows them. In part, some of this is confusion. I mean, remember, ISBN originally equated to product SKUs. But now when you've got 50 different EPUB formats, or EPUB delivery formats out there, well, maybe 50 is a little bit high, do you really want to assign a unique ISBN to Kindle versus Nook versus Apple Store and so on? Do you want to have an internal book ID for your publishing requirements? Do you want to assign DOIs? How many of you noticed in your packets this morning there's a thing about cross-ref for books? Do you guys look in your packets? Get the hands up, look in the packets. You should be doing, okay, I saw a few hands. You should be doing DOIs for books. And there are some, I don't have time to tell why, but there are some very compelling reasons more and more why you want to make sure you do them. You will ultimately, if you're not doing them, you will start losing people coming to your website. Okay? Do you have a type classification for your books? What's the publisher and imprint information you want? Copyright, publication date and edition, and so on. What do you want at the book level? What do you want at the chapter level? These are all things you need to think about in inventory, and each publisher typically has their own unique requirements. So a lot of what you want to do up front is just inventory all of these requirements, and essentially what these slides are in part are things we've learned that we need to sit down and go through with publishers. So if you are a book publisher and you haven't done this, but you're thinking about XML, this is what you need to think about. Touch quickly on some different parts of the book. Fronts, title pages, copyright page, table of contents, prelims, some issues. Title and half-title pages are a real headache to do real XML because none of the DTDs that are out there have really detailed metadata to support them. But what you can do, if nothing else, and I've got some little fragments of NLM DTD, you can do things like just have plain paragraphs, but use a content type attribute. So you can uniquely distinguish what this is versus what this is, but still have very rich metadata for things like the title and the contributors. And this information alone, a content type, can be enough to drive a unique look in a typesetting template. So sometimes you don't need to make the DTD really rich. You just need to take advantage of features that can make your XML really rich. Tables of contents, should you add them to the XML or not? I think most publishers are not adding them. And generally, my take on tables of contents is if you can build the tables of contents from the individual chapters, then you shouldn't have them in your XML. You should build them on the fly. Why? If you make a change in one of the chapters, then you have to remember to change the table of contents somewhere else. I mean, how many of you have ever published a book where the table of contents didn't match in the front what was in the chapters because you made a last-minute correction? Okay, think about it. XML is a technology that can allow you to avoid that kind of problem. So we generally recommend excluding them and just building them on the fly when you're composing the book. That's also going to be true when you think about what's the value of the table of contents in different types of electronic environments. They're going to look very different. Prelims. These can be thought of as mini chapters. They're usually very simple, but they run into problems with things like unnumbered artwork or a signature line of the contributor of that prelim down at the bottom. And should they be in one file, even if you've got all your chapters on a per file basis, or many files? I'm not giving you all the answers here necessarily, but things to think about. Backs get a little more complex. You have bibliographies and references, notes, glossaries, indices. Bibliography and references, well, first of all, the easy one, if you've got them, start linking them to Crossref. If you're in an XML workflow, it makes it much easier to do that. Again, this is stuff that people are thinking about. It's not required by Crossref the way it is for journals, but it is desirable. But the bigger problem is linking to these from the individual chapters. If your XML isn't all in a single file, then you've got to figure out how you're going to establish and maintain those links. I know, for example, Wiley has a fairly complex system for doing this in their DTD. You're nodding your head over there. So it's a non-trivial problem. And again, I'm not giving you all the answers here. I'm just pointing out these are things to think about. You might consider actually moving from back-of-the-book bibliographies to per-chapter reference lists. Notes are probably best to place in each chapter, again, unless it's just going to be one monolithic book file. Again, it avoids the linking problems. However, what you can also do is if you want to, in the PDF, place them in the back of the book, you can always have a script that just picks them up from each chapter and coalesces them all together into the back of the book. Glossaries are something that are sort of cool because what you can do if you set it up correctly in XML is have an inline tag that's a cross-reference to a glossary item, and then maybe in the back of the book actually have all your definitions collected together. But if you do that right, what you can do is have these automatically placed by a typesetting script out in the margin, or just leave them all in the back. So the XML actually gives you a fair bit of flexibility in how you set all this up. Indices are probably the single most challenging piece. Every publisher I've talked to about indices in the end has sort of thrown up their hands and said, we're going to keep doing them the way we have been doing them, which is we're going to build them after we have the PDF proof pages, and they'll go in the back of the print PDF, and we really don't know what we're doing on our electronic product. They're a challenge because it's a workflow issue. For a print index, you can't really create it until the book is paginated. The tools also aren't good. Every indexer I know can't stand words indexing tools, but they aren't used to working with InDesign and indexing tools that are there that probably aren't a lot better than Word. And then if you want to think about truly having richly hyperlinked indices in the XML, it gets even more challenge. But indexes aren't dead yet. I mean, if you think about how people use electronic product, they're often not even using an index, so why bother with it? Because, hey, you can use search. Well, I've talked to a lot of scholars who tell me the first thing they do when they pick up a new book is they actually flip not to the table of contents, but the index, because that tells them a lot more about what somebody put into that book and what information they're going to find in it. So they're not dead yet, but the workflows for developing them are pretty heinous, and I don't have good answers here yet. I'm going to finish up with some challenges in the body content, boxes, tables, discontinuous lists, and the infamous C page problem, which Bill and I have discussed at length. Journals, if you have sidebar boxes, are typically pretty simple. Box 1, box 2, box 3. Books, you might see box 1, example 14, and exhibit 1 all in the same chapter in G, all with different looks. Well, they're actually not as challenging to handle as you might think, because from an XML perspective, you try to put a content type based on your label, and boom, you can apply a different template here based on that attribute than you would for this box or that box. So you can actually handle complex boxes, which are one of the more challenging aspects of a lot of books, much more easily than you may realize. Table formatting, what you do tend to see in books a bit more than journals are shaded cells and unusual cell borders. These can typically be handled just by extending yourself into some of the HTML style attributes, or really the CSS style attributes in tables. In NLM, we also have something called styled content that we sometimes use. Something, again, you rarely see in journals, but you see in books are discontinuous lists, where you've got a list that has a few items, then sometimes one paragraph, sometimes many paragraphs of text that are not a continuation of list item 3, but sitting smack in the middle of the list, and then you pick up with item 4. Okay? Couple of ways you can handle this. I've highlighted them both in red here. The first is, unlike most journal articles and publishers where you do not keep the label, you just base the numbering on the order and you generate the numbering when you're rendering the content, here we can actually keep the label on each and choose to either drop it when we render and number automatically based on the list type of ordered, or we can actually render using these numbers so we know we've got exactly the numbers that were intended. So when we hit this additional list here, we know that that's item 4, not a new number 1. The other thing you can do with some of these XML models is you can have a continued from attribute. So here's list 1, here's list 2. This continues from list 1. Oh, okay, we got to go back and pick up after number 3 and do number 4. That's more complex in the rendering engine, but it does give you another option if you don't want to keep the labels. I know, it's getting pretty late to be showing you this depth of example. I'm almost done here. Past index is probably the single most difficult problem is, in particularly in humanities, all the authors who say, and see what I said over here on page 253. Now, in a print world, that makes sense. You flip back to 253. In an online world or an EPUB world where you don't have the same pagination as the print book, it makes no sense at all. The problem is a lot of authors aren't used to hooking that concept to a specific paragraph or section heading. They're thinking of an arbitrary point in the text when they do that. And it drives publishers nuts already in a print world because you can't fill in those C pages until you're at the final proof pages to begin with. But it's even worse in the electronic world. And Bill and I have had a lot of discussions, and I think we've agreed right now there are no good solutions to this, short of maybe pointing people to a numbered paragraph or a section.
There's solutions that don't involve work.
Right.
Yeah.
So this, like indices, is something where sort of stay tuned, but these are the gotchas you're going to hit. Finally, an afterthought, and it's literally almost an afterthought because I only stumbled across this one 3 days ago. I happened to subscribe to a LinkedIn group, I don't even remember which one, which had this discussion thread, and the slides will be up so you don't have to try to copy that heinous URL. When you publish the book, you need to actually include in the first edition a URL to where people can go to find errata about the book. Because if somebody's looking at the book electronically, they need to know, gee, this is where I can go to find out what corrections have been made. And this is actually a really good example from Berkshire Publishing of how they actually handle their errata. But the trick is knowing you need to put this out in the first edition. How many of you have just put pieces of paper into copies of your book as you start accumulating the errors? You just slip a sheet in there that's got all the corrections so people know. You can't count on doing that in an electronic book. So you need a way of keeping track of them, and you want to put this in the first edition and then keep the website up to date. So 3 years ago when Bill gave his presentation, except for Elsevier and Springer, most people weren't doing ebooks. Now we're seeing more and more people really doing them. The key things to understand with this are, first of all, the production requirements are more complex than journals. The XML requirements are a bit different. The workflow requirements, particularly because of the heavy use of InDesign, are a bit different. You have to be aware of the limitations of InDesign. But all of these can be overcome if you put the thought into it up front and you work carefully. And yes, you can use XML ultimately as a product driver, but even more importantly as a manner to gain efficiencies and to gain accuracy in your overall end-to-end book publication workflow. Well, thank you very much.